Welcome to the History of the Catholic Church in the United States. I am Father Charles Connor, a priest of the Diocese of Scranton, Pennsylvania, and an adjunct professor of history at the University of Scranton. This is going to be a survey course in 13 episodes of the history of the Roman Catholic Church in the United States, and hopefully each and every one of us will be brought more closely in contact with our Catholic roots in this country, and even more importantly, we will become much more devoted, loyal Catholics who love our faith all the more. North American discovery as we know it, and as we look back upon it, really had its origins at the end of the 15th century. North American colonization had its origins at the end of the 16th century. So we're roughly talking about 100 years between what the initial discoverers were going to be doing and what the initial colonizers were going to be doing. When we start talking about North American discovery and we start talking about North American colonization, we have to begin with Spain. Spain was the earliest colonizer for the present-day United States. And the colonizing efforts of the Spanish really span three centuries. They begin with the foundation of Puerto Rico in 1493, and they continue all the way to the establishment of the final Spanish mission at Sonoma, north of San Francisco, in 1824. And in those three centuries, a tremendous amount of activity took place. So as we now begin this course, we can say that San Juan, Puerto Rico, is the oldest diocese in the present United States. It was established in 1511. And when its first bishop, Alonso Manzo, came to Puerto Rico, he was the first of his ecclesiastical rank to set foot on what would become United States territory. Now, before we can start looking at Spanish colonization in the New World, we have to take a little look at the country of Spain herself. At the end of the 16th century, you will not find a more Catholic power in Europe than Spain. The faith was deep-rooted. It had been there for centuries. It was the one country where I suspect the most ardent Catholicism was going to be found. And as a result of that, there was a tremendous seal of Catholic energy placed on each and every one of the colonizing efforts of the Spanish. Secondly, you will not find a country in Europe where there was a stronger, closer, more intimate church-state relationship. For example, in the 16th century, there was a papal bull, or we'll call it a papal decree, given by Pope Julius II, which stated that the Spanish government, had to give approval for the establishment of any monastery, any church, or any religious house that was to be opened either in Spain or in one of Spain's colonies. Imagine, the Pope is saying that the Spanish government has to give approval for the opening of a religious house in Spain or in one of her colonies. In many ways, that kind of thing was a tremendous help to Spanish colonizing efforts, but in other ways, it was going to prove to be a detriment as well. And finally, one other factor to be kept in mind about the Spanish is that when the Spanish government began colonizing efforts, when the missionaries began to arrive in the New World, particularly now we're speaking about Franciscan missionaries, who was it they were going to meet in the New World? They were going to meet the Native American Indians. And as those missionaries came to the New World, they saw each and every one of the Native American Indians they met not as someone to be colonized, not as someone to be inculcated with Spanish culture. Rather, the Spanish missionaries saw each Indian as a soul to be saved. That is tremendously, tremendously important. And all of these factors, as we say, have to be kept in mind as we start talking about Spanish colonization. Herbert Eugene Bolton is a name not known to too many of us, but in the early decades of this century, Bolton was the president of the American Historical Association. And every year at the annual meeting of the American Historical Association, the president gives his presidential address. Bolton was not a Roman Catholic himself. But in the year of his presidency of the American Historical Association, he devoted his presidential lecture to the topic of colonization, and he was talking very specifically about Spanish colonization in the New World, and he was drawing a contrast between the Spanish and the French and the English and other nations who attempted colonizing efforts. Very specifically now, in relation to Spanish colonizing efforts, Bolton said this. He described them as, quotes, a force which made for the preservation of the Indians as opposed to their destruction, which was so characteristic of the Anglo-American frontier. In other words, the Spanish were very concerned with the plight of the American Indians. The other countries, somewhat less concerned and probably engaging in colonization for economic profit as much as anything else. That was an interesting comment, though, from a man who was looking at it from outside the household of the faith. Well, where did these Spanish people come from when they came to colonize the New World? Or I should say, where did they come to when they came to colonize the New World? They came, first of all, to Florida, and they came officially on the 8th of September, 1565, under the direction of General Pedro Menéndez de Avilés. And they took formal possession in the name of God and the King of Spain of the Indian village of Saloy. No sooner had they arrived here than they renamed the Indian village of Saloy the village of St. Augustine. And in the village of St. Augustine, they established the mission of Nombre de Dios, the name of God. You can still go to St. Augustine, Florida today and visit a replica of that original 16th century Spanish mission. The mission was under the pastoral care of one Francisco López de Mendoza Grajales, the first pastor resident in what is today United States territory. The mission of Nombre de Dios was the beginning of a string of missions that was going to extend throughout Florida. And it was primarily the Franciscan fathers who were going to really comprise the greatest thrust of missionary activity throughout what you and I know as the present-day state of Florida. You so often read contemporary accounts of these early Franciscans who went to Florida. Many of them gave up and went home. They thought the exercise was going to be too futile. They thought they were not going to make converts. Their health gave out in a climate in which they were unaccustomed. But many of the Franciscan friars did not go home. Many of them stayed. And those who stayed became the nucleus and the thrust of the church in Spanish Florida. Those Franciscan friars who stayed watched the territory change. They and their descendants watched the territory change from Spanish to British, back to Spanish, and finally into American hands in 1824. Now from Florida, we want to move in a westerly direction across the Sabine River into Texas. When we talk about Texas, we're talking largely about the eastern portion of what would be today the state of Texas. And very particularly, we are talking about the area around the present-day very beautiful city of San Antonio. In San Antonio, you have the establishment of a military post and also the mission of San Antonio de Valero, begun in 1718. You and I would more affectionately refer to that mission as the Alamo. Spanish Texas, if we can use that term at all, was already very thinly populated, and we have to therefore move a little further to the southwest to get a bit more of the story. Dreams of reaching the legendary seven golden cities of Cibola led a man by the name of Francisco Coronado to undertake what became a very, very famous expedition. Coronado traveled to the Texas Panhandle as early as 1540, and his people eventually reached what would be today the current area of Kansas. Then smaller parties going out from Coronado's original expedition went on to discover places like the Colorado River, the Rio Grande, and the Grand Canyon. From there we go to New Mexico, the current-day state of New Mexico, as you and I understand it. And in New Mexico, Spanish and Indian races and cultures merged, and they created a Native American and an American Catholic culture, second in seniority only to that of the American Indians. And as early as 1630, an official report, just for New Mexico now, just for New Mexico, noted that there were 90 Franciscan friars, 24 missions, and 50,000 recorded baptisms. An amazing, amazing story. If we continue the journey on a little bit further to Arizona, we find the first non-Franciscan missionary effort, and this would be a missionary effort engaged in by the Jesuits, and very particularly by Father Eusebio Kino. Father Kino was a native Austrian, a very famous cartographer, one who read maps, one who studied maps, and one who wrote maps himself. And from the cartography work of Father Kino, and also from many of his extensive writings, we have an invaluable account of Catholic life in the American Southwest. Father Kino began the mission of San Xavier del Bac. It was truly a great missionary experience for the Jesuits, but it was somewhat of an isolated missionary experience, because as we continue the story yet further west and come to California, we return once again to the Franciscans. It's interesting when you start thinking about Spanish colonization, the first thought that often comes into your mind is California. But in point of fact, we have seen that a great deal went before the establishment of the Spanish missions in California. When we think of California, we think of Father Junipero Serra. When we think of Father Junipero Serra, we think of the 21 Spanish missions that were found along the King's Highway, El Camino Real, a day's journey apart, from the south of California at San Diego de Alcala all the way to the final mission of Sonoma north of San Francisco. Father Serra was a university professor. He came from the island of Mallorca, and he was a man who had a very genteel life as a university professor. He then became somewhat of an itinerant preacher in his native land, but finally he said, "No, I simply cannot have any more of this. I want to be a missionary." And to California he came to be a missionary. One contemporary biographer describes him as a, quote, plump, rosy-cheeked man approaching middle age when he arrived on these shores. He came here, and he writes himself in his own memoirs, "All of my life I have wanted to be a missioner. I've wanted to carry the gospel teaching to those who have never heard of God, who have never heard of the kingdom." And carry it he did. Of those 21 California missions, Father Serra personally began 9 of them. And around those 9 missions which he began, the social, the political, and the economic life of the state of California began to grow up in the 18th century and into the 19th century. And upon Father Serra's death, we find a very, very strong missionary chain, and we find a large number of Franciscan friars. Spain, of course, was not the only power to colonize in the New World. And having discussed the Spanish, we now want to turn our attention to the French. When we start talking about the French colonizing efforts in the New World, we realize that the French came one century after the Spanish. So instead of talking about the end of the 16th century, we're now going to begin talking about the end of the 17th century. France was very much concerned with political events in Europe, and so their attempts at colonization were somewhat slower. And I think we can also say the attempts at colonization on the part of the French had a somewhat different motivation than did the Spanish. We do not want to suggest, for example, that there was any less spiritual a content in the French colonization. The French black robes, the French Jesuits, were every bit as much spiritual men as were the Franciscans. But France herself had a somewhat different motive in colonization. France had an economic motive. The government of France was very concerned with having a lucrative fur trade, and they wanted to get the easiest possible route to the fur trade in the New World, and so when they decided to undertake colonization, they decided to do it as quickly as possible. When we speak of the French, no more than talking about California with the Spanish, it seems that when we speak about the French, our thoughts immediately go to upstate New York, and particularly to the small French village of Auriesville, New York, where incidentally you can still go today and visit the Shrine of the North American Martyrs, which is conducted by the modern-day Black Robes, the modern-day Jesuit fathers. And we also think of a very famous man who came to upstate New York, the saint with the mangled hands. Those of you who went to parochial school years ago remember that book, Mangled Hands. Father Isaac Jogues. Once again, he was a university professor. He taught at the University of Rouen in France. Very comfortable, very genteel life. But he came into the New World to be a missionary, and he came in a rather indirect kind of way. Father Junipero Serra came, first of all, into French Canada, and he was captured by the Iroquois Indians. Now, the Iroquois themselves had been in Canada for centuries, and it's a rather long and political story, but they had to be taken out of Canada by the French government, and they were brought from French Quebec down into northern New York State, around the area of Auriesville. Now, Father Isaac Jogues first arrived in Canada, and his first encounter was with the Iroquois Indians, those who were by nature quite hostile to the French and to French missionaries because of what had happened to them in the past. So as soon as Father Jogues encountered some of the Iroquois who were still left in Canada, what happened? They took him as a prisoner and they brought him down to northern New York State and they subjected him to incredible tortures. It wasn't just the Iroquois, by the way. The Iroquois were joined by the other five nations, the Seneca, the Cayuga, the Oneida, the Onondaga, and the Mohawks. They formed an alliance, if you will, and they all became natural allies, or natural enemies, I should say, of the French missionaries, of the French black robes. It really was only the Algonquin Indians and the Hurons who befriended the French Jesuits and seemed to become their natural allies. Well, Father Isaac Jogues, as we say, was captured by the Iroquois, and he was brought down to the present-day area of Auriesville, New York, subject to great, great tortures, but he was able to get out. They smuggled him down to the village of New Amsterdam, which would be the present-day city of New York, and they got him on a Dutch ship and brought him back to France. And not only did he return to France, but he returned to a hero's welcome in France. After he had been back in his native land for just a few years, what did he do? He did not lead a comfortable life. He decided that he was going to return once again and try to minister once again to those Iroquois Indians who had been anything but friendly to them. After he came back, we know the story very well of St. Isaac Jogues, St. John de Brebeuf, all their various companions who were martyred and martyred very savagely at the hands of the Iroquois Indians in upstate New York. That's not to say that they didn't do a great deal of work. It's not to say they did not convert a great number of Iroquois Indians to Catholicism. They certainly did. But there were many, many strong enemies in the Iroquois tribe who were never going to be converted, and they were the ones who ultimately saw to it that Father Isaac Jogues and his companions lost their lives. The American historian George Bancroft, again not a Catholic, makes a very, very interesting comment about the black robes in upstate New York. Bancroft writes, "Not a cape was turned, nor a river entered, but a Jesuit led the way." He certainly had a man like Isaac Jogues in mind when he said it. He certainly had a man like Father Marquette in mind when he said it. Remember Father Marquette, the famous missionary who accompanied Louis Gillette on a 2,700-mile expedition on the Mississippi River. He certainly had a man like Father René Maynard in mind, Father Maynard, who explored the shores of Lake Superior. French Jesuits were to be found among the Illinois Indians at Kaskaskia. They were to be found at Fort Arkansas. They were to be found at Fort Orléans on the Missouri. And they were to be found at Vincennes, Indiana, on the Wabash River. The list of French missionaries could be expanded over and over again, but we would want to consider in this broadcast only one other Frenchman, and that would be the famous French Sulpician, Father Gabriel Richard. After the Treaty of Paris in 1783, which ended the American Revolutionary War, there were a number of forts under the control of the British in the old Northwest Territory, and they were going to remain under the control of the British for a number of years. In fact, the British would not evacuate the Northwest Territory until 1796, long after American independence, well into the Washington administration. Now, after the British left the Northwest Territory in 1796, there were still many, many Catholic people living around these forts. Well, who's going to minister to the Catholic people? That became the concern of the Bishop of Baltimore, a man by the name of John Carroll, of whom we will have a great deal to say later in this broadcast. And John Carroll it was who appointed this young French Sulpician, Father Gabriel Richard, to administer to these largely French-speaking Catholic people who lived in the old Northwest Territory. Gabriel Richard is a very interesting man. He introduced the first printing press in the United States. He edited the first Catholic newspaper in the United States. He helped found the University of Michigan, where he served as professor and as a member of the first board of trustees. And he was the first Catholic priest to serve in the United States Congress as a delegate from the Michigan Territory. Imagine, the 1790s, we have a priest that active in what would already have been a somewhat pluralistic society. Now, my friends, we've looked at the Spanish briefly, we've looked at the French briefly. There's one other way in which the Spanish and the French left a tremendous legacy in this country. One other way besides colonization. The other way came about in 1803 during the administration of Thomas Jefferson. You may recall from your own study of United States history that it was in that year we had the Louisiana Purchase. That purchase doubled the territory of the United States. We acquired any number of cities along the Mississippi River and along the Gulf Coast, and we acquired a tremendous hinterland which extended beyond these cities, a still unexplored hinterland. We also inherited a tremendous Spanish and French culture because both of these nations had done a great deal of colonizing work in the territory that we call the Louisiana Purchase. Most importantly of all, we acquired the great city of New Orleans. Very early on in its history, New Orleans had become an international port, a gateway to the Gulf of Mexico, a gateway to South America, a gateway to Europe, really, for all of the fur trade that would be coming down the Mississippi River and from the tributaries of the Mississippi. And interestingly, in 1793, Pope Pius IV established what was called the Diocese of Louisiana and the Floridas. The Diocese of Louisiana and the Floridas. Hence, we can say San Juan, Puerto Rico is the oldest diocese in the United States. Baltimore, Maryland would be the second oldest diocese in the United States. And finally, the Diocese of Louisiana and the Floridas would be the third oldest diocese in the present United States. Hence, we have the Spanish and we have the French. Theirs was a tremendous legacy, a wonderful story of colonization, and yet in many, many ways, the Spanish and the French became strangers in a country they helped to create. Because the focal point of colonizing efforts was really not going to be with the Spanish, it was not going to be with the French. What was the focus of colonizing efforts? It was summed up, really, I think, by Governor John Winthrop of Massachusetts. John Winthrop, the famous diarist, who said, "We shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people will be upon us." John Winthrop was talking about Puritan America. The Puritan was to be this new man. The Puritan was to be this new American, this new creation that Alexis de Tocqueville would talk about. John Winthrop, the Puritan, left England, and his fellow Puritans left England because they had been persecuted. But they would turn around in this country and they'd become the persecutors. They would particularly become the persecutors of those who did not adopt Calvinistic theology. They were very, very anti-Catholic. They did not at all appreciate that which had been done by the Spanish, that which had been done by the French. As a result, a marvelous, marvelous legacy was certainly not lost, but it was diminished in importance, because the major thrust of colonizing efforts would be done by the British. Well, did Catholics come anywhere near what John Winthrop was talking about when he started describing the city on the hill? Yes, they did. Catholics did play a role in British colonizing efforts in Maryland, in Pennsylvania, in Virginia, and in New York. And in our next episode, we shall turn to those great Catholic colonizers who came to the British colonies and who in many ways gave us the faith we know today.